Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast, a conversation where good thoughts help renew the mind with the Word of God. I'm Charlie Carter, and I'm here with Tim Little and Andy Stearns. Let's jump into the conversation.
Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast. Shalom. How are you, gentlemen?
I'm feeling very good. My mic's in a new position, and I can't see Tim now when I talk like this, so
yeah,
it's okay.
That's a little annoying.
You gotta kind of pop your head out from behind the microphone.
That's fine.
I'm doing just fine. It's a nice summer day.
Yeah, we just turned the AC off, so I'm not freezing cold anymore.
You know, earlier today, though, it wasn't as bad as it was the other day. It was like a crisp.
Nice.
I think the rain last night really helped.
Yeah.
Helped my
you
garden.
Know how
that's
old
what
I
helped.
Feel saying stuff like that? I just realized that. I might as well put some like New Balances on and wear cargo shorts. Oh, I got the cargo shorts.
They're horrendous.
I'm horrendous.
Are Birkenstocks better?
They are nice. They're a little, you got to wear them in. You got to wear them in, but they're nice. They're low maintenance.
I've always wanted to get Birkenstocks, but I've never bought Birkenstocks.
Me too. They were a gift.
Speaking of Birkenstocks.
Yes! Yes!
Whatever. It's a horrendous transition.
Oh, I was just kidding. I was letting you get to the next thing.
So the next thing is we're trying to get 200 reviews on Apple Podcasts. So give a 5-star review and leave a comment. Don't forget the comment. Has to have a comment. Then we have our sponsors and coffee. Today we're having our Canadian coffee.
Eclipse Roasters. That's very good. It's very, very nice.
It is. It's
Charlie
very,
would
very
not
good.
Know. It's too far in the afternoon for him.
Yeah, not drinking anymore.
Then we got our Normies, Brick House, Porch Light, and Blue Cow, the friendliest.
Heard around.
That sounded weird. It didn't really go that well as I thought it would.
That's what I heard.
Okay, so there we go. That is all of our announcements. Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast, listeners. We're going to transition now to
books and business.
Let's talk about some books.
So you need to go last, right? Because you got the you need to go first because you got the devotional.
Is that how that works?
Yes,
you should go first.
It's in the wrong order on the
template. I think last time we had you.
Let me pull that up because I am not prepared.
So listener, today Charlie is going to give us
the devotional. Does it
so
say Fokelman on there? Is that what's there?
Fokelman.
Okay. Yep. Yes. So I have been reading the book title is Reading Biblical Poetry by his last name is Fokelman. It's a book I'm borrowing from Tim. So just kind of talking about how to read biblical poetry. And I'm not that far yet, but I like what I'm reading so far. And I think the last chapter is the one I'm most excited for. I can't remember what he calls it, but I think it's like something like the attitude of reading poetry or something like that. So anyway, yeah, that's what I've been working on.
Yeah, that attitude, just like poetry and how it's just different. It is fascinating. I'll see what you think of that when you get through it.
I agree with it on the front end. That you have to understand you're reading something different. You have to think, but I don't know how to describe that yet. We'll talk about it in a few weeks.
So in my PhD class, one of my PhD classes, I had a PhD class on Hebrew poetry. So I had to read a whole pile of Hebrew poetry books. And one of them was, you pick one, pick a Hebrew poetry book. And that was the one that I picked. So that was not an assigned book. I chose it because I wanted to learn about Hebrew meter. And so the meter chapter is kind of what I'm most familiar with in that book, but some of the other stuff.
So just one more thought there. So I was driving to church the other night and I was just listening to the radio, which, you know, sometimes is good, sometimes is bad. And a song came on. It's a popular song. I'm not going to mention it. I'm not going to pay any credence to or publicity to the person that was being sung. But I noticed something about it. I was like, wait, were those two lines the same amount of syllables? And then I was like, oh, wait, hold on. There's a rhyming scheme to this. It was like A, B, B, C, C, A, A. And it was like, and then you get into the chorus and it had its own rhyming scheme. And the thought popped into my mind. It's like, oh my goodness. This is poetry. It's just really bad poetry.
Like, horrendous.
It's like the lowest form of the art where it's just like getting you to like what they're saying because of what they're talking about, but it's not, there's nothing deep or meaningful about it. And it was kind of a sad moment of reflection that if you could go back 1,000 years, the popular songwriter is David. And he's writing hits like Psalm 51. And then today, we've just got trash. And so anyway, I might have more to say about that at later, but it was fun to, like, that's what they're doing. Like, they're writing songs and very specific, they're doing the same thing. The only difference is it doesn't mean anything. It's just frivolous, but, or it's evil in some cases.
So I don't know what to say. I don't want to offend listeners, but I do find this interesting. I think something that goes along with some of that, because when I was a window cleaner, I heard all the secular music. And I don't know how I happened upon this, but there's a band, and I don't think I could recommend them, but they have this one spoof video, not a spoof, like a spoof video on YouTube. The band is called The Axis of Awesome, and it's called Four Chord Songs. And they play over 100 current day pop hits with the same four chords.
Yep.
And the lack of creativity. And you can see that the music industry really is a machine to, like, move your emotions around so you'll buy stuff.
Yep.
And then the words are just like free association or existential meaningless or whatever. I'm with you. I'm totally with you, man. So not supporting any of that. I'm just saying it is an interesting reductio ad absurdum to show, like, hey, there's no creativity here.
Okay, so my turn.
Drum roll, please, people. We have one and the only.
It's not
random, Tim.
It's not that great.
Oh, okay,
but fine. Anyway, so I have a mug. Two of my sons were in Arizona.
This is so good, listener. I wish you could see this.
This is a rattlesnake, and inside of the mug is a rattlesnake. Like a ceramic rattlesnake. So it's like you pick the thing up and take a sip, and it's like, oh, I'm about to be bit by this thing. You never drank out of it, though?
No, I've never
drank. It'd be really fun to drink out of it, and then if it had like a dark liquid like coffee, and they don't see it, and then they go to take a sip, and they're like, whoa, what the snot is in my cup? Okay, so I'm going to do a second one. So I've got a couple of new units for... Hey, it's supposed to be random,
this is
right?
Great. No, random Tim is the best. I'm serious.
Star Wars Legion, so the game that I play. I've got a new list that I've been experimenting with. They released a new unit for the Galactic Republic, the Commandos. So I'm running a couple of squads of Commandos and experimenting with that. So there's Random Tim.
I love this. This is great. All right, listener, I've got the larger of the books in business this week. What I'd like to do is give my final analysis of the book, The Wisdom of the Bullfrog by Admiral William H. McRaven. All right, here's what we're going to do today. It's going to be a little longer, but I think this is worth spending the time on. So what I want to do is the book is set up with 18 principles. And each one of them is a leadership principle. It has like a quippy statement, and then it has a parenthetical, more clear or explanatory statement. And then under each one of these are the three summary statements in the book that summarize the chapter. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to walk you through a sampling of a few of these. And the main thing I want to talk to you about is I'm going to categorize all 18 and then just kind of give you an example of each of the three categories. After that, I just want to give an overall summary and assessment of the book being a leadership book. I want to ask a question: in what way is this beneficial? And then I want to make an application to another topic if it flows that way and if we have time. Okay, so we're going to walk through an overview sampling of the commands or the principles. I'm going to tell you what I think my three categories are if I had to categorize them. I mean, you might categorize them differently. We'll have an example of each, maybe two, and then we'll talk about my overall assessment and where I'd go with it. So you want to say something?
Nope. Let's hear it.
If you get this book and you go to the like last page or two, he says, hey, this is all in a PDF. And you can get the PDF. And so you can go right now and download PDF Wisdom of the Bullfrog, and it will give you the 18 principles. Now, I'm going to give you a couple of examples here. The first one I'm going to read it in its entirety so you get the feel, but I won't do that for all 18. That'd take too long. The first principle is death before dishonor, which is to say, and then this is the parenthetical statement, you should be a person of integrity. Now, in this chapter, he talks about death before dishonor being one of the mainstays of the United States Armed Forces. They will go back for their own. They will go through pain. Other nations know that if American troops are on the ground, that's a real problem because they're not just going to run when it gets hard. They're going to be there for you. So it's a really cool chapter. There are three summary statements. One, you should be fair and honorable in your business dealings. It's the only way you and your employees can leave a legacy that you can be proud of. Number two, you should never lie, cheat, steal, or tolerate those who do. The culture of your organization starts with you. And then the third explanatory statement is you should own your lapses in judgment. It happens to everybody. Correct the problem and return to being a person of good character. Now, that's one example, and there are 18 principles that he's going to give you. And some of them, I could read the statement and you would know what it says. When in command, command. That means, like, if you're the commander, do your job. Let's see here. Hope is not a strategy. And that one, he's going to tell you that you need to plan. You can't just hope it's going to work out. Expect what you inspect. Hey, good advice. If you expect something and you don't inspect it, you're never going to know if you're getting it. There are other ones that are much more chapter specific. Like number 17 is, can you stand before the long green table? Well, that's the court martial table. And he tells this big story about a court martial situation. Some of them are going to sound familiar even to those of us in the church. So number 12 is a shepherd should smell like his sheep. I've only ever heard of that in the context of ministry. He doesn't use it in that context. He uses it in the context of a corporation. So when I look at these 18, I'm trying to think, is there, like, how would I think about these? And so I've got three categories that I sort of thought of them as, and I don't know that these are accurate. I think they make sense to me, but I could totally see someone making a case for different ones. But still, I think this is worth our time. So the first category I'm going to give you is that some of these principles fall under what I would call the moral advice or moral virtue category. Now, when I say moral, that's different than saying biblical. Anytime you talk about what is right and wrong, and you say, this is what's right and this is what's wrong, you're speaking morally, whether you're using the Bible as your source or foundation or not. Now, sometimes you get it right, and that would be general revelation. That would be your conscience. That would be C.S. Lewis in The Abolition of Man calls that the Tao. It's this moral idea that everyone has from their conscience. But sometimes it's just what you think is right and wrong, and you're not right. And I would say that some of these are purely moral. And so the first one, death before dishonor, that's telling you to have integrity. Now, did you notice all the moral language there, guys? How many sins and command, like how many sins did he mention in his three explanatory statements right there? Because it was all laden with what we would think of as like sins or commands not to do this or that. What do you got quickly?
Yeah. Don't lie. Don't cheat. Yeah. Be fair.
I mean, it kind of sounds like a short version of the Ten Commandments and maybe some of the other moral advice you might find here or there. So it's, you see what I'm saying? When he says, that one of them is when you're in command, he says, be confident in yourself. That's not exactly like a moral statement. He's just giving you advice of like, and I would call that a skill category, but some of these are moral statements. So the second one, you can't surge trust. And his argument, his command or his principle there is that you need to be trustworthy. Well, he is going to make statements in that chapter where he makes it sound like if you're not trustworthy, that's a bad thing because you lack integrity, going back to the first one. So I would simply say that four of these are moral or virtue language. One I want to point out real quick, because this one's kind of a cool story. The fourth principle is we all have our frog floats. Now this one, and it says you got to have a little humility. Now humility, again, that's like a moral statement, a virtue. This goes back to like, Aristotle, the Bible, like people talk about humility. So when he was a junior officer, I believe, he was distinguishing himself very well as a squad commander. And one day they had just finished a swim And someone came down, a messenger of some sort, and said, you need to meet right now with the general or whatever of the camp. And he's like, oh man, this sounds like, oh, this is good. I'm going to get a promotion or there's a special mission for me. That's usually what that meant. So he runs, he changes, he goes and stands before the commander. And the commander says, hey, McRaven, you have really been doing well. You've distinguished yourself. And he's super excited. And he says, I got a special mission for you. Next week in the community, there's a parade, and the SEAL team always does a float with a giant frog on it, because SEALs are called frogmen because they swim. And I need you to oversee and build that float. McRaven walked out with a big chip on his shoulder, very frustrated and disappointed. Here he is training to demolish things and run special missions and be an effective fighter, and his commander's saying, go build a parade float. Well, he had this older grizzled soldier pull him up, put him under his arm, and say, hey man, look, this doesn't sound very fun, but listen, you just got to be humble and do your best. And that'll, in the end, it'll serve you well. So what's he do? He did the best frog float that he could, and it ended up helping him out. Now, that's like a moral statement, okay? So there's a lot of moral instruction in this book. But none of it is coming from the Bible. However, my second category is what I'm going to call, I'm struggling with a label, Bible connected, not biblical. Biblical makes it sound like it's from the Bible. I would just say that there's some way that a Christian might look at this and say, hey, that kind of reminds me of the Bible.
Like the shepherd smells like a sheep.
Yeah, that's the example. That's one of the big examples. When you have heard that before, Tim or Charlie, what has that phrase communicated to us in the ministry context that we're in?
Got to be around the sheep.
And who needs to be around the sheep?
The pastor.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, you need to be out with the people.
Mm-hmm. A lot of times, especially like in like a larger church, it may be that you could show up and leave and you'd never be around the pastor. Or it may be that a pastor has a big online presence, or he's very into the preaching and he never gets out and knows the flock. And Peter says that you should be among the flock. Like that's part of the pastor's responsibility. So if a pastor's never getting out in the flock, he's missing something. So I've heard a shepherd should smell like a sheep in that context. Well, he's essentially saying something super similar here. He talks about you should go and spend time with the rank and file soldier. You should go and spend time with the people you're working for. This is very similar to Elon Musk's principle and philosophy. So his office is on the factory floor and he has glass walls. And that is so that all the people who work for him can see when they show up at 6 a.m, he's already there. He works all day. And then when they leave at 5 p.m, he's still there. And the idea is that you lead by example and you know them, so you know how hard it is for them. Hey, that kind of has a lot of biblical crossover in some Christians' minds. One of the other ones is that you should listen to your employees and get to know them. That one, that's number 13, Troop the Line. He talks about going around and getting to know the people and knowing what's going on. And when they have a problem, you listen to them. It reminds me of Proverbs 8:13, where it says it's folly to answer something before you've heard the whole situation, like heard the whole matter. So some of these things as a Christian, you're probably going to think, hey, that reminds me of something maybe I thought of in the Bible. So I'd call those Bible connected. The third category. Oh, go ahead.
It's Proverbs 18:13.
18:13. Okay. Yeah. I got that one off. I want to make one comment though. And this is really, you gotta hear me here. I am not saying the source of these is the Bible at all in any way. I'm simply saying that I could see some Christians saying, hey, this is basically a Christian book without the Bible verses. And I would say, no, he is saying things that may sound a little bit similar, but he's expressly not coming from the Bible.
And then on that note, guys, I had a thought pop into my head when you were describing these. So what would you say, you're reading this book, and it's like, it's a Christian book. And then, it's not. But then if I could come back and say, well, isn't all truth God's truth, Andy?
Ooh. So, I would agree with you. All truth is God's truth. The problem with this book is that it's not all truth. It's much of it is interpretation or just philosophy of life. And that is not all biblical. And so maybe I should jump ahead just a little bit to my assessment. I'll say this. Bring me back in 2 seconds to that, because I can tell the third category real quick. Listener, the first category is what I'd say are moral instructions to you. The second category are things that are instructions or advice that's going to sound maybe connected to the Bible, but it's not. He says he's not coming from the Bible. Or he could. It could be the Quran. It could be the Bhagavad Gita. It could be any holy book. It could be something like that. He says this in the last chapter. The third category is what I would say is simply skilled advice. And here is where, and Tim, you can look this up if I get it wrong. I think it's Proverbs 22:29 says, do you see a man who is skilled in his labor? He will stand before kings. And I think the rest of this advice is expressly from his experience as a SEAL team commander. And in that is perhaps where the Christian's going to have a question of what do I do with this? Because he did very skillfully carry out his job. And Solomon seems like he's telling us to listen to people like that and learn what we can. So that's a question I'm going to let hang. Maybe we could talk about that at the end. But all truth is God's truth. The problem here is that all this truth, even the, let me say it like this. The advice in this book is not always fleshly, okay? Fleshly would be like sinful motivations or sinful advice, okay? But it's always earthly is the word I'm going to use. And by that, I mean sourced from here on earth. Experience, general revelation, general observational data from your living life. Even the stuff that might seem kind of biblical is still just earthly. He's not using the Bible. He's not using revelation. Whatever he's getting, he's stumbling upon through trial and error. And the reason he's telling you to do these things is because they succeeded for him. So if I tell you do this because it's going to lead you to success, that is a pragmatic argument. Because what works is what you should do, is what you're saying there. So we've sort of looked at the 18 things. We've looked at the three categories. My assessment is that if you read this book on leadership, what will you learn? I think you'll learn some good experiential stuff. Is all truth God's truth when it comes to experience? The problem there is it doesn't take into account motivations, and none of this is sourced from the Bible. It's all sourced from experience. I would say it like this. What if he gave this advice to somebody else and somebody else said, hey, I'm going to carry this out because I want to succeed. And that guy carries this stuff out, carries it out perfectly, and then he fails at his job. In that situation, he would say, oh, this advice doesn't work. And then he might do some immoral things. And if that does work, guess what he's going to say? This is what I'm going to do. So I think the reason that this book is weak is because it's advice based on experience. And if he hadn't succeeded, he wouldn't be saying these things.
Yeah, like, so when I'm thinking through this, the component that seems to be missing, at least connecting it to a biblical wisdom, is the fear of the Lord. So like, I don't know, the death before dishonor. So don't lie, cheat, or steal. Well, why? Because you're going to get found out and then you're going to be fired, or so it's like a pragmatic reason why you shouldn't lie, cheat, or steal, as opposed to the fear of the Lord.
Yeah, and you can literally reverse that. It's not the fear of the Lord, it's fear of getting fired.
Yeah, fear of getting fired.
Or fear of failing.
Right.
It's a fear of failure, not the Lord. I would totally agree. I think that's a perfect summary of it.
So the whole idea of like the frog float and even the humility, okay, be humble. Why? Because then you'll be...
Because there's a payoff.
Yeah, there's a payoff in the end.
One day it'll make me look better to everybody.
Right. And a lot of times in God's wisdom, in the way that he's ordained and made the world, that works out. That is what happens. But that can't be the driving motivation. The driving motivation has to be the fear of the Lord.
There was a book, I'm not going to say the title, that was like an advice book for marriages, and... The guy, it was good advice. We would all read the book. But I was talking to Jeff Newman and he said, it's a good book. He's like, but a sinful wife or a sinful husband could put those same principles at work and get the same effect because it doesn't address the motivation behind it. And so then you've got, it's kind of like what you were talking about in your book that you're working on in the very beginning, where it's like, well, what if I do the right thing for the wrong reasons? And is the standard success or is the standard the fear of the Lord?
Well, the example that I use in the book over and over and over is a mechanic. So should a mechanic not lie, cheat, and steal? Well, of course, because if that's his business model, then people aren't going to want to go there. And then he's going to lose money and he's going to look bad. And so a good mechanic is going to be honest. But guess what? Your car doesn't care if you're honest. You don't need that.
That's exactly
right. If you're going to talk about character, there has to be another footing there because pragmatism erodes it. If, well, I can lie and make more money. So
it's really interesting too, because where I could see this book blossoming is in, well, the leadership world, but then I could see, so in business classes, even at Christian colleges, books like How to Win People and Influence, or Win Enemies, you know, how to, like, those sorts of self-help books, or like John Maxwell, like a lot of that stuff is advice that I do think fits with, I don't know what you want to call it, Tim, the order of creation or the way God designed things.
Yeah, the way it's wisdom.
Yeah, and it is. It's wisdom. I do think you could call it wisdom, but it lacks what you're saying, the fear of the Lord. And so then it's our motives are fraught with this. So here's where I think I want to go next. Oftentimes, especially in my past, I would say that Christians would, to use a Lewisian term, baptize something so that they could use it. And so if a book was really, really good and it had any shred of something that might sound biblical, Christians would say that's actually, like, the reason that works is because God's designed it that way. And we know it works because we see the success. Now, here is where I think there's a ministry corollary. I'm thinking of there's churches out there that are very engaging and they're very large and they're very successful. They have a lot of people who attend. They share the gospel. They're very evangelistic. And I would say those are like big networks like Saddleback, Harvest, like those sorts of seeker sensitive style movements where, like, our gathering is made for the unbeliever. They kind of have a lowest common denominator goal, and it's that it would be like professions of faith. I could see a context like that, like one that I came out of, being ripe to see a book like this and think this is really good because it would lead to that. But I think that misses a whole bunch of the Great Commission. The Great Commission is not only professions of faith, it's discipleship, it's consistent Christian living. And these principles, I don't know, I could see where you could take, it's not that you'd use this book, okay? That's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying the pragmatism underneath this book is very similar to what I would say you see in church growth movements in the Christian church. It's a pragmatic argument. So when I think of Troop the Line, where you got to get out and get to know what's going on with your people, what does Rick Warren do? He goes out and takes a poll of 80,000 people where he's at and says, what do you like, of people who he doesn't know if they're Christians or not. And then, hey, what do? They do exactly what the community likes. So people will come in. It's like an attractional model ministry. Now the Christian world looked at that and said, oh, this is great. Look at this big ministry. All these people are showing up. But what was it? Maybe good motivations, but at the end of the day, it was pragmatism. And it missed a lot of biblical instruction. So, super long review. Sorry, these are summer episodes, but what do I give this book? I like books about seals and war and stuff like that. And it was an interesting read, but I'm not going to, I don't know. There's some like what you like earthly wisdom that might help people. But
yeah. You know, the order of creation,
yeah.
If you don't lie, cheat, or steal, then usually things go well for you. And a lot of his stuff here, I mean, you kind of put it up here for us so I can look through and scan through some of them. They're really helpful. So,
yeah, it's not like bad stuff.
Right. It's just incomplete.
It's the motivational component, mm-hmm. or the reason, the motive component is wrong. So I don't know. between a 4 and a 6, mm-hmm. I don't know, 6 is pretty high.
You just have to remember a lot of this stuff's really good, but there's always an Isaiah or a Jeremiah where God tells them, nobody's going to listen to you, but you need to just say the word anyway.
Yeah.
And be faithful. So pragmatically, it fails. Even Jesus in his ministry, he states in Isaiah 49:4, I pulled it up here. Then I said, I have labored in vain. I've spent my strength for nothing and in vain. And at the end of Jesus' earthly ministry, he dies and everybody scatters. Was that a success?
I mean, he was doing what the Lord called him to do.
Yeah.
So it was, but look at what's the world going to say about that?
But Jesus himself says, I've labored in vain. I spent my strength for nothing and in vanity. But then he states, yeah, surely my just reward is with the Lord and my work with my God. The fear of the Lord's got to be the foundation.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I have a hard time. 4.5. I'm glad I read it. It was interesting. It was, I think,
4.
Yeah, I think the 4. I think the exercise of analyzing it with you guys was, I think, worth more than the book. Mm. But it was still interesting if you like war books, if you're a leadership nerd or something. I'm not. You probably want to read this, but I would say it's earthly. It's not all bad, but it's earthly.
So I have a couple thoughts.
Bring them on.
One, you mentioned at the end, I like books about seals and war. You should write a fiction book about war seals. That would be super thrilling to me. Just a thought.
Charlie, I'm doing it. At least a short story. Yeah. The war seals.
And I had another thought there too, and I think it's gonna just elude me. I was getting ready to write them down because I knew I'd forget one, and I forgot one.
I'll just tell you, war seals are very elusive. So
yeah, they are. That's why they're good at fighting. You can't catch them. Anyway, so let's have a final meditation in God's word. And I have been in Psalm 84 quite a bit recently, and it was assigned to me as part of a summer series at Maranatha. We've been doing it for about 4 years now, going through the Psalms just in the summer. And so I've had a couple of opportunities to do that with my church. And also want to give a shout out to Clarinda, Iowa, and First Baptist Church, and then Harvest Baptist Church, who have also heard me preach from Psalm 84, because if you're going to preach from a psalm, why not preach from it 3 times? And so,
amen.
We talked about this a few weeks ago. I just want to review it very quickly. What is in Psalm 84? So there's 3 main divisions, and that's verses 1 through 4, where he really expresses his longing to go to the temple. Verses 5 through 8, he, whether literally or in a spiritual sense, like maybe like prayer, he's going to the presence of God. And he talks about his journey through the valley on his way to the presence or the temple. And then he arrives and his prayer goes up in verses 9 through 12. And what we have there is his actual prayer. It's his requests. And so we're going to focus on that third section. He makes a request in verse 9 is where his prayer starts. He says, "Behold our shield, O God, look on the face of your anointed." Our shield and your anointed are probably references to Israel's earthly leader. And which is also interesting that if this isn't a time of exile, or whether it's written in exile or not, they're praying that God would provide a king or a leader. And then he gives 2 reasons why. And you can see them in English, verse 10, 4, and then verse 11, 4. So there's 2 reasons. You could say because. He said, praying, Lord, behold our shield, our protector of the nation, and look on the face of your anointed. Your anointed would also be the king of Israel. Because, and reason 1, a day in your courts is better than 1,000 elsewhere. I would rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than dwell in the tents of wickedness. So that's reason 1. And so I just want to think about that phrase there, or really the whole verse. So in verse 10 in Hebrew, it's just 5 words. It is because, the word for because, then the word for good, because good day, there's 3 words. And then there's this like 2 big kind of bulky words. And those are the words for one, or better is 1 day than 1,000. And then in your courts. So better, because better day, and it's implied single, a day, because a day in your courts is better. than 1,000. That's the 5-word phrase. It takes us quite a bit more words to parse it out in English, but it's 5 words in Hebrew. And so then you can kind of learn a little bit of what he's saying by looking at the contrast at the end of verse 10. So better is one day than 1,000. I would rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than dwell in the tents of wickedness. So you have a couple things being contrasted. One is a very small thing. In verse 10a, the small thing is the one. And then in the second part of the verse, the small thing is the humble beggar at the front of the temple. And then what's the comparison? So I'd rather have the one or the humble beggar than 1,000 or to dwell in the tents of wickedness. So it's this idea that in the first part, one day in God's temple is better. I'd rather have the lowest, most worthless position there than live and dwell, be thriving in another place that is not God's temple, or here he calls it wickedness. And I'm also wondering, the tent for Israel would just have such a meaning to it, especially if they are out of the land, like they're not in their permanent dwelling. So I'd rather have one day in the permanent dwelling of God's house than thousands in tents. And you know, you could think about some meaning of the wilderness wanderings. You could think about the exile. And my mind went to Daniel, where he is in exile in Babylon. And what does he do when he prays? He opens his window and he faces towards Israel. And what is he praying? And we by the way, this psalm is titled, you know, For the Sons of Korah. And that could be, okay, maybe those are the author. It could also be the group of musicians it's intended for. I just like to imagine, like, would Daniel have prayed something like this? Like, man, Lord, just bless the leadership of Israel so we can go back. And that's kind of my creative imagination. This could be like a Daniel thing or another king, if it was written by someone during a time where they're not in exile. Could it be a David or a Solomon who is out at war and he's fighting, trying to keep the nation protected? And because of that, he's not able to go to the temple. And in that context, the leader or maybe another troop in the army of Israel is praying for God's protection because they know that going home to the permanent dwelling of God is so much better than all of these other places. And so that's kind of what's in verse 10. And I think as you try to apply what he's saying there, it is quite a statement of affection. So there are not a lot of things that we like to take only one of rather than thousands of them. To give you examples that popped into my mind, if I offered you $1 or I offered you $1,000, what would you take?
Oh, $1,000 all the day.
$1,000.
Like right there.
And, you know, something that I particularly had struggles with is cars. And so if you're like, Charlie, I'm going to give you one car, or why not have 1,000? You could literally have a car breakdown for 3 years and you'd have a backup. Wouldn't that be great?
especially with all your car travails you had when you got your,
and that so would be nice. There aren't many things. Now, Tim, we were talking about this a few days ago, and Tim brought up, well, what about like something really bad happening? You would maybe want less of those. And I did think of a good, you know, I think Solomon actually does address that. In a good day, what do? You rejoice. And in a bad day, you still consider, this is still from God.
Mm-hmm.
And so even in a bad day, the recognition of God's sovereignty would be a good thing. But anyway, so I think it's a very unique statement of affection for the psalmist to genuinely say, I would trade thousands of other days living in what could be prosperity or fun or entertainment, certainly earthly comfort. I would trade thousands of those days to be one day in the courts of God's temple in his presence. And I also think it's very significant to say I would take the position of the humble beggar at the door, to be at the door of the temple rather than to be in some prominent tent or place elsewhere. And so I think that's a really good thing for us to think about is what would I trade What do I love? What do I long for more than the presence of God? And what would you, are there things that you would want thousands and thousands and thousands of, but really pale in comparison to one day in the presence of God? And of course, there are just hundreds and hundreds of examples that we could come up with of, oh yeah, I really love this and I do it all the time. And they can capture us and captivate us more than they should. So there's no person who reads Psalm 84 who shouldn't be challenged by that in their affections. The difficult thing is to then, you know, realign your loves. So if one day really is more important, then I better love God with all my heart. And God tells us then what's next. And then I should love my neighbor. And, you know, all the other things should be cut out. And so, yeah, quick thought there from Psalm 84. And if you guys want to jump in and say anything, just, you know, you can go right on ahead and I'll wrap it up there in a moment.
I would just say that it's funny the way you shared this. You made the point that you could be trading 1,000 days in comfort, at the very least comfort, I think is what you said, for one day here. And I just thought that how hard it is for us today in our world to be uncomfortable. And to say that I would be comfortable for 1,000 days and I'd be willing to give it up for just one day. It's funny. You'd think it like possessions, money and all that. But I think in our culture today, like comfort's actually a live option to consider there. Cause I like my comfort. I love my comfort.
Air conditioning.
I know.
It's kind of building even off of the pragmatism and stuff that we discussed just a moment ago and how, well, what is the good life? Well, the good life is the good stuff.
Yeah.
And that, no, what you really have to value to really find heavenly wisdom is a fear of God. And for you to really, truly do things wisely, you need to have the sentiment of the psalmist here that you want a day in the courts and or a day near the Lord and how that's better than 1,000. So this is a very, very good text that coincided with our books and business.
Yeah. And I'll probably come back to it one other time because I think what is unique about it is thinking through the differences in the worship system under which the psalmist is writing this to what we have today. So it's, excuse me, not an exact one-to-one comparison of how you think that through, because we don't have to go to the temple to offer sacrifices. You know, we don't have to draw near that way. There's other things. And so I do think there's a lot of great application to think about there. But for now, read through verses 1-4 and the psalmist saying, man, I long. I faint to be in the house of God, to be in your presence. I would trade thousands of days, and it's hyperbole. He's saying all of them. I would trade all of them for one, to be in the presence of God. And can you say that about your own affections? And if you're human like the rest of us, and you can't say, yeah, I really love him all the time perfectly, then just today, how is God trying to shape your affections, and what could you do to love him more? Thank you guys for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Thinklings Podcast. We would love to hear from you. If you have any feedback, suggestions, or potential topics that you'd like us to discuss, you can contact us through our email, thinklingspodcast@gmail.com. Remember, don't let this conversation end with this podcast. Read good books, talk about them with your friends, and always continue to cultivate your mind. See you next time on the Thinklings Podcast.